I just want to start off with saying, in the very early hours of Thursday morning, 24th of February, the country of Ukraine, as many of you would know, was invaded by Russia. If I was to be frank for a moment, this is the type of leaders, kings, and rulers humanity has produced throughout our history. Our history is marred with broken plans, twisted pursuits, and violent ends. And over 2,000 years ago, this is the type of king that Israel craved. A human king. A king who would conquer the Romans and put their nation back into preeminence. But this isn't the king that God had promised. The high king of heaven, the true ruler of heaven and earth, the master of all reality, didn't come as a Putin or a Biden or a Morrison. He didn't come as a Hitler, a Stalin, or even a Caesar. No, this conquering king came not like an earthly king. He didn't enter this world with fame or flair, but with humility and gentleness. But make no mistake, our king is more lion than cub. He was no pushover. He came to wage war, but not on flesh and blood, but against the powers and rulers who twist and turn human beings into nothing more than animals and numbers. He came to defeat that which was truly evil and destroy that which truly ensnares us, sin. And yet so many people couldn't see Jesus for who he truly was and is and what he came to do. And so today I want us to encounter our king on his terms. I want you to see the contrast of what is going on in our world to the king that God presents us. And I want us to be captivated by him. Let's pray. Dear Father, you know exactly what is going on in our world. And Father, there is so much cause to grieve and to be angry. And yet I'm reminded of your Son. Why do the nations rage against you? Why do they plot? And Father, there is no greater king than you. So Father, would you help us this morning to encounter again the king we've come to worship? Would you help us to know Christ and know him deeply? And I pray all of this in Jesus' beautiful name. Amen. Just quickly, Tom, is that going to hang down on that? Will that probably help? Or is it just going to ring? Oh, it's okay. Look, there's a lot to get through, so I'm going to break up today's chapter into four acts. And hopefully it all comes together. Look, Act 1. It's called Transfigured, an Old Testament Encounter. Look with me, Mark chapter 9, verses 2. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John and led them up on a high mountain by themselves to be alone. He was transfigured in front of them, and his clothes became dazzling, extremely white, as no launderer on earth could whiten them. Elijah appeared to them with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it's good for us to be here. Let us set up three tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." Because he didn't know what to say, since they were terrified. A cloud appeared, overshadowing them, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." Suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, he ordered them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept this word to themselves, questioning what rising from the dead meant. Now, really, I want to be real honest. This whole scene reads like something out of The Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter. A tale of fiction, not truth. It's a bit too almost far-fetched. But the reason I think we find it that way isn't just because the wondrous imagery where you've got Jesus going up on a mountain and then appearing like a Gandalf wizard trick with dazzling white. But I think it's because we don't quite understand what is going on. Why does Jesus do this? Why does Moses and Elijah then come appear next to Jesus and then disappear as Jesus, as God speaks from the clouds, and then Jesus say, "Don't tell anyone"? If you're confused, where you're in good company, because the very three blokes that Jesus takes up the mountain is equally confused. They witness this in flesh and blood, and we're like, I don't know what's going on. Listen to what Peter says. "Rabbi, it's good for us to be here. Let's set up three shelters, tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah," because he just didn't know what to say, since they were terrified. I love that Peter, that loud, outspoken fisherman, who seems to say just the first thing that comes into his head, has no idea what to say, but suggests, "Hey, let's build tents." I don't even think they had materials to build tents. It's great. But more than that, they were terrified. Meaning this whole scene is just as jarring for them as it is for us. So why does it happen? Why does Mark record it? And if we miss this, the rest of it doesn't sort of make sense. Firstly, you have to remember what was confessed just before this. Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Firstly, he says, who do people say I am? People say he's a prophet. He's Elijah, he's John the Baptist, resurrected. And then he asks his disciples, "Who do you say I am?" And this beautiful moment where James sort of taught us last week, Peter says, "You are the Messiah, the Christ, the promised King of old." And yet, in the next breath, his disciples get it wrong. Peter tries to take him aside and say, "Hey, Jesus, you are the King, the promised King of old, the one that God has sent. But you might need to change your plans. You're not meant to die. You're not meant to suffer." And this is the point. Jesus, the whole way through, has been showing his followers, showing us who he is, regardless of our suppositions, our preconceived ideas of what we think Jesus should be. And so Jesus grounds his identity in a much larger narrative. He affirms the confession that he is the Messiah. And he also brings to light that his arrival is remarkable in history. Not because he appeared out of a vacuum, random and unintentional. Because no one in history has impacted our world like Jesus has. And I know I say that in the light of thousands and other remarkable human beings who have come. But Jesus is more. And so Jesus is affirming something that all of us need to get our heads around and for his people to understand. That Jesus was anticipated right from the beginning. And what makes him so compelling is that for thousands of years of recorded history, history that is full of promises and remarkable signs and wonders, prophecies and timeless songs, all of it is pointing to him. So in this scene, if you like, Jesus grabs all the threads that the Old Testament, that period before Jesus coming into the first century, all that history, he grabs it and ties them together and anchors them in himself. He says, "I am what all of this has been pointing to." It is why we see Moses and Elijah here. Moses, if you don't know, was the great ancestor of the Jews, one of the great leaders of Israel, who played a major role, not only in their rescue from slavery from Egypt, but also the one who mediated between God and his people. He was the one who was given God's very laws written on stone tablets. He's the one that God showed the back of his glory. He was, for every Jew, every Israelite there, revered and adhered. But listen to what Moses says at the end of his life, what he says to the people of Israel in Deuteronomy. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your brothers. You must listen to him. And so here he is, Jesus. And you can't get any more clearer than this. When, like in times of old, when God spoke to Israel from a cloud, God does it again and affirms what Moses had prophesied. And God says this, "This is my beloved son, listen to him." It's like a big flashing fluorescent arrow just pointing out the obvious. Yes, he's the Messiah. Now listen to him. That's why exactly why we get also the famous prophet Elijah, who was also prophesied as one day coming to prepare the way for the Lord. Both these figures, along with the setting and the signs, declare that Jesus isn't some random historical freak accident. He isn't confined to some pop star in the first century. Jesus is what the whole story that God has been writing is about. Jesus is the climax, the anticipation of the whole Old Testament and the hope for all our futures. Jesus is showing us that yes, he is the Christ, he is God's son, that you need to listen to him. But why? Okay, for a moment, you're on the hill, you see all this amazing stuff. But why does Jesus have to give this evidence in the first place? Think about it for a moment. He's already shown it. He's already cast out demons. He's healed the sick. He's made the blind see, the lame walk. He's allowed the deaf to hear. He's raised the dead. And he's brought them to life. He's shown time and time again. Why does he have to keep providing evidence? Beloved, it's because he loves us. Because he knows we find it hard to accept him as he is when we want him to be what we want him to be. You see, because the coming Messiah was so anticipated by Israel, that's where the problem lies. I mean, think about it for a moment. Everything you've ever waited for in your life, whether it's music from your favorite artist, a movie that you've wanted to see, whether you waited in line for a restaurant or waited to see that sporting match, whether you've waited for that new piece of technology or waited for the elections for a new political leader, all of this anticipation creates expectations, all sorts of hopes, prospects, and presuppositions. Now, mix in a few thousands of years of anticipation, and you can imagine what they expected Jesus to be. But their expectations were wrong, very wrong. So Jesus lovingly, graciously, patiently, powerfully continues to show them that this is the King, the Messiah. This is what he came to do, that he came to suffer, to die and to rise. Israel wanted a political mastermind, a tactician, a warrior king who would overthrow the powers to be. But God instead gives us his son, a king who came serving rather than being served, a king that writes into the narrative, the story of life, that he would suffer, endure pain, harm, abuse, injustice, and death in order to be our sympathetic high priest, to be our true substitute, our true redeemer, our true savior, our true king. That's the reason he keeps telling people not to talk about him. He's saying, wait until you see the whole picture and you put it together and you'll see me for who I am, not who you think I am. Son is an introvert going, look, don't tell people about me because I'm a bit shy. That's not why. He's just clear about his mission. And so he says to them as they were coming down from the mountain, he, Jesus, orders them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. Because at that point, it all makes sense. And so the transfiguration, this moment where Jesus has this Gandalf-like moment, where he shines a dazzling white, all of that serves to confirm that the suffering Jesus will eventually endure is not incompatible with his glory. He is the transcendent God. And look at what this transcendent God came to do. He's trying to break the misconceptions of what this king should be. But unfortunately, the disciples still don't get it. That's why they asked the question about Elijah. They're still trying to piece it together. But Jesus, wasn't Elijah meant to come before you? They're trying to work through their presuppositions. They still have doubts and questions. They still don't fully get it. And if we're honest enough, this is our story. Aren't we just like Peter, who can confess on the one hand that Jesus is the Christ and in the next breath tell the King of all creation what to do? Don't we speak or think things before understanding the full picture? Don't we at times go, look, I don't know what's going on, but I'm just going to go with it and hide our doubts and our fears? But this is why I find the Christian faith so compelling. It engages with all of this doubt, worry, and fear. It engages with our suffering, our pain, and darkness. And it grounds it not in some abstract truth or doctrine or sentimental garbage, but in a person, in a relationship. We see truth not void of its many facets and beauties. We see truth personified. Jesus wants us to know that he loves us even in the midst of our doubts and our questionings. Which brings us to one of my favorite encounters in all the Gospels. Act 2, Help My Unbelief. Read with me verse 14. When they came to the disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and scribes disputing with them. The whole crowd saw him. They were amazed and ran to greet him. He asked them, what are you arguing with him about? Someone from the crowd answered him, teacher, I brought my son to you. He has a spirit that makes him unable to speak. Whenever it sees him, it throws him down and he foams at the mouth, grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive it out, but they couldn't. He replied to them, you unbelieving generation. How long will I be with you? How long must I put up with you? Bring him to me. In 2004, HBO made a show called Entourage. I haven't seen it, nor would I recommend you seeing it. But what I found interesting about the show was its premise. The show revolves around an up-and-coming A-list actor and his friends who sort of try to benefit from his fame. Hence Entourage, that's what Entourage is. Now I can imagine that in a setting like Hollywood, that these friends could have easily begin to think of themselves more important, more highly. They thought they were almost on equal level as the star. And I flag that because this is exactly what is happening with his disciples. And you have to grasp this in order to understand why this part of the story is so important. You see, not only have the disciples failed to put the picture together, but they're also failing to grasp what their involvement in this story is all about. Because you see, Jesus gathered, invested, and sent out 12 particular disciples to preach the gospel, which you think, okay, that's good. He then gave them the power to cast out demons and heal the sick. In other words, sort of mirror what Jesus has been doing already. But you think, okay, that sounds like, yeah, I could do, you know, Jesus can do that. But imagine for a moment that as you're sent out without Jesus next to you, as you start to preach the gospel and crowds start to gather, and as you start to heal the sick, as you start to speak and demons flee, how it begins to slowly get to your head. The shift may be subtle at first, but happens from look at what Jesus can do to look at what I can do. Look at how I cast out demons. Look at how I heal the sick. Look at how I proclaim the gospel, the good news of Jesus. You can start to see an arrogance rather than a dependence grow. You can almost see it in their hearts going, look, Jesus, I've got this. Just leave it. I'll go heal that man. But upon coming down the mountain, we find these very disciples arguing with other religious leaders because they couldn't do what they thought they could do. They couldn't cast out a demon. Now, you might think that all strange, but for a moment, you've got to grasp that these disciples for a while now have been surrounded by crowds, popularity. You've got to understand what that does to a human being. Look what it does to us on social media. And then you have Jesus, in the light of all that, say something that seems a bit bizarre, but actually gets to the heart of the problem. Verse 19, Jesus says this, "You unbelieving generation, how long will I be with you? How long must I put up with you? Bring him to me." What are they unbelieving in exactly? Why does he call them an unbelieving generation? What aren't they trusting in? And what does this have to do with what they've been arguing about? Because the two aren't disjointed. They work together. Well, the clue is in his direction. He says, bring him, the boy, the child, to me. Now, keeping this in mind as the story unfolds, and I'll come back to it. For now, I just want you to notice another sort of powerful instance where we see something quite remarkable. Where they do bring the boy, and we see in another instance the true destructive nature of demons. Which again, if you follow Mark's narrative, he doesn't often comment about. Often Jesus cast out demons, but you don't hear the interaction too much. Apart from the man who was demon-possessed, and you hear a bit of his backstory, this is one of these other instances where we hear a bit more of a glimpse as to what's going on. We start to see what the kingdom of Satan truly looks like. And so as they bring the child to Jesus, the demon throws the boy on the ground, and Jesus asks the father, how long has this been happening to him? And now remember, Jesus doesn't ask questions because he doesn't know the answer to them. He asks them because he wants us to listen to what is about to be said. So listen. The father says, from childhood, and many times it has thrown him into fire or water to destroy him. Notice what this demon does to a child, who we would say, in today's culture, the most vulnerable and powerless. What does a demon do to a child? It tries to kill him. And like the pigs illustrated in chapter 5, go read it if you don't know the story, we now see in chapter 9 the true implications of their nature. Demons aren't a mild inconvenience to your Christian walk. They are about the destruction of life. These forces of darkness and evil, apart from Jesus showing up, would have gone unnoticed and unchallenged. So you can imagine for a moment the hopelessness this father feels. He's heard that Jesus has cast out demons, but he's just brought them to these disciples and they've been powerless to do anything. What hope does this father have? Well, he has the hope of the one who is the true light of the world that expels the darkness. And so Jesus, almost like an ultraviolet light, reveals all the stains and marks that we don't often see, because it's only Jesus who unveils the full extent of darkness. It's why you hear so much about demon possession and it being exposed. It's because the true light of the world is shining and no darkness can hide. And so when the Father finishes saying to Jesus that this is how long it's been happening, he says to him, "But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." It's almost like asking, if a fish can swim, Jesus, can you do something? And so Jesus responds with a tenderness. If you can, everything is possible for the one who believes. And here it is. But here is also the point where so many people abuse this idea. Here is the point where so many people uplift the power of belief rather than understanding what Jesus is pointing to. Let me be very clear here. Jesus isn't elevating the power of belief. If that were true, the power of self-belief would be greater than Jesus any time of the day. You wouldn't need to be here. Just go into the world and believe in yourself, and anything would be possible. That is not what Jesus is teaching. It is related to what he said earlier. You unbelieving generation. Unbelieving. Now, the word belief is a wonderful word. But when it comes to our modern context, it can often be a tricky word. Because we usually associate belief as things that aren't true. So you believe in fairy tales or myths. You believe in things that aren't proven. In this sense, the word doesn't make sense. That's not how the word originally is explained. The word more, if I was to give it an equivalent in English, is more like trust. You see, trust is given because you see evidence. It's not blind or ignorant. It's often relational and rational. So Jesus never wants you, when you come here, to clock off your mind and think, oh, okay, I'm just going to believe in this stuff and hopefully it'll get me something. It's not how that works. It's rather the opposite. You should be engaging all your mind, heart, soul, and strength to make sure what is being said about Jesus is actually true. So what is this generation, if I was to take the word unbelief out for a moment, what is this generation not trusting in? Think about it for a moment. They come down from the hill. The disciples can't cast out this demon. And he says to them, "You untrusting generation." Why does Jesus say everything is possible for the one who trusts? Just replacing the word believes, remember. Because he wants to draw everyone to this wonderful conclusion. Trust me. Trust in Jesus. Believe in him. Jesus wants to draw out who or what we trust in. He wants to expose it and say, my disciples aren't the point. Demons aren't the ultimate power. I am. Everything is possible, not because of the power of belief itself, but because of the one we trust in. It is because of Jesus that everything is possible. Because if Jesus is who he says he is, the King, the Messiah, the God of the heavens and the earth, the one who spoke galaxies into existence, who shaped the valleys and the hills, who could say to these storms with just a whisper, stop, and it would shine. If he truly is who he says he is, then yes, everything is possible when you trust in him. This is where true power lies for us as Christians. Not that we're awesome and powerful and we've just got a really positive, chipper view of ourselves. It's not that we have all the answers and solutions, but rather we know who we can turn to. We know who does have the answers, who does have the power. And this is what I find so beautiful. The Father gets it. His disciples have been with him this whole time, but the Father gets it. He gets the paradox of believing Jesus but wrestling with it too, and he cries out to Jesus, "I do believe, help my unbelief. I do trust, help my distrust." He gets the paradox. And beloved, this is what the disciples failed to understand. But I want to ask you, do you get it? Do you think that this Christian life following Jesus is all about you performing great miracles? Do you think it's about your power of belief, how much you can muster so I can just storm the world? Or do you get like this father gets, that you're just as fickle and frail as anyone else, but we have a God that loves us and gets us? And so the power of faith isn't in our ability to believe, but as I said, but it's trusting in the one who holds us and who keeps us. It's about realizing we can turn to someone even when we struggle to trust. Think about that for a moment. Think about just how beautiful it is that even in your moments of struggle, even in your moments when you don't quite get what's going on in your life, when there is suffering and pain, when you don't have the answers to the questions others may ask, or you even have the questions answered that you have in your heart, there is someone you can turn to and cry out to who will listen and be with you through that. That God doesn't sit in his heaven, in heaven going, "Well, I gave you a chance to trust, too late." Rather, you have a patient king who labors with his disciples, and if you know the story, even to the point when they betray and abandon him. Do you know what's so devastating about Ukraine, apart from the obvious? That there are so many people crying for help and hope, and there are so many who don't even know that they can turn to one who does listen and care. Beloved, I still have so many questions that God hasn't answered for me. But he's shown me so much love, grace, mercy, and compassion. He's shown me so much evidence, reasoning, and proof that I can trust him when I don't understand, when I don't get the answer I want, when I don't see the full picture. And I love this father's response, because in his agony and honesty, he grasps what so many of us forget or neglect. "Jesus, I do believe, but help my unbelief." God isn't waiting out there for you to stuff up. He isn't demanding your life on the one hand, but then leaving you to work it out on the other. He doesn't call you to deny yourself and carry your cross without first him doing that and then being with you when you do it. Jesus understands that trust is a lifelong lesson. It's an action, not just a noun, where we'll stuff it more than we'll nail it. So we can confidently cry out, "I believe, help my unbelief." Now there are two applications that stem from this in Acts 3 and 4. And just because of time, I'm going to draw out these implications quickly, but ask any questions at the end because there are going to be things I'm going to miss in these last two portions of chapter 9. But let's look at Act 3, the greatest, when the first are last. After casting out the demon, healing the son, the disciples, still not getting what Jesus has been trying to show them, the disciples ask him, and it's really insightful, this question. You've got to understand, the Father gets it. I believe, help my unbelief. This is what the disciples ask. Why couldn't we drive it out? Jesus, why couldn't we do what only you can do? And he masterfully points them to prayer, which, if you know anything about prayer, is always an act of utter dependence on God. In other words, Jesus says to them, it's not about you. Read with me. Then they left that place and made their way through Galilee, but he did not want anyone to know it. For he was teaching his disciples and telling them, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after he is killed, he will rise 3 days later. But they did not understand this statement, and they were afraid to ask him. They came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, what were you arguing about on the way? But they were silent, because on the way they had been arguing with one another about who was the greatest. Oh, gosh. You have some of the disciples who are in this argument, who have just been on a hill, seeing Jesus like dazzling white, something that no human can do. You see him come down the hill, cast out a demon that no other human could cast out. And their discussion? Who is the greatest? It seems so superficial, right? I mean, you look at them and you go, what idiots. Because we wouldn't struggle with that type of thinking today, would we? I mean, when it comes to us, we never think we are more important than someone else. We never look down on people. You know, we're good Christians. We never look down on people. We never talk critically of others behind their backs. Because remember, we're so lovely. We never avoid certain people because we know they're taxing or annoying. We don't go, oh, that person's there. I might just go over this way. I love you all, and you never avoid serving or helping at church because you would rather be doing other things than be here, right? None of us really struggle with that at church. None of us think we're greater than what we truly are. So this argument that's unfolding for the disciples isn't really our thing. It's just really, oh, they're just dumb. Beloved, can I be honest as your pastor? Every one of those things that I just mentioned, I wrestled with this week. The problem isn't that I don't care about Jesus. It's just my heart likes to think me more greater and more important. That is my natural disposition, beloved. When I wake up in the morning, it is about me and me alone. Yet, beloved, seeing Jesus as the greatest allows us to see the worth of others and ourselves. Because if Jesus is the greatest, then you can actually see people for who they are. If Jesus is the greatest, you start to see how Jesus models his greatness. And Jesus doesn't show it by demeaning or demanding like some sort of pompous ruler, but by serving and forgiving. He doesn't show he's greater by ignoring or avoiding, I don't have time for you, but by searching and finding. He doesn't show that he's greater by snubbing or gaslighting, but by loving and patiently listening and receiving others. Jesus doesn't assert himself because he's insecure about who he is. No, rather, he is so secure in who he is, he's able to show humility and count others as precious and of eternal value. You see, Jesus says to his disciples, if anyone wants to be first, he must be last and servant of all. If this whole thing is about a relationship with Jesus, then, beloved, we need to start molding and shaping the way that Jesus models and shows us how to live, rather than how we think our Christian walk should be. And I get there's so many, in our world today, in the West, there's so many conflicting and demanding things, whether it's work or family or friends or family, whether it's your own pleasures and your own desires, whether it's the footy match, whether it's, oh, I want to go to the beach, whether I want to go on a holiday. But, beloved, we need to start molding and shaping our lives around the relationship that we claim to have. Do you know what Jesus does to illustrate it for his disciples? He grabs the most vulnerable, weak, and powerless being on the planet, a child. Imagine little Elijah. He grabs little Elijah, stands in front of all the disciples there. All these men who have been with Jesus, who have thought for a moment that we're pretty good. Jesus chose us. We cast out demons. We heal. We preach. Look at us. He stands a child before them. And you've got to understand how precious this movement is in Mark. He then grabs the child in his arms. Think about that action for a moment. That the transcendent God of the universe would grab a child in his arms in a discussion about who's the greatest and says to them, whoever welcomes one little child as this in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but him who sent me. Beloved, do you know how breathtaking those words are? To equate the value and worth of a child, this vulnerable, powerless, weak creature, as welcoming God himself. Seeing Jesus as the greatest allows us to see the worth of an actual human being made in God's image. It allows us to serve others lovingly and joyfully because it frees us from trying to perform religion. Like this whole deal, I know that when you get up in the morning and you have to dress for church, the point isn't to appear better than you are. You don't have to fake this. This is the one place you should be honest. I am struggling. And it frees us from being distraught about how broken and sinful and a stuff-up we are. Jesus came for those very people. Jesus pressed us into something more compelling. A relationship that reassures us, like holding that child in his arm, that you are held by the King of the universe. Why are you talking about who is the greatest? Do you know what a Russian president needs to comprehend? That he is not greater than the King of heaven. That there will be a day when he stands before the true King and he will ask him who is greater. Make no mistake, beloved. Our God is a God that loves justice and righteousness. He doesn't wink at injustice and murder and violence. He puts himself last to save people, but make no mistake, he is still the High King of heaven and earth. The final hours, limbs, hell, and salt riveted. Verse 42. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believes in me to fall away, it would be better for him if a heavy millstone were hung around his head and he was thrown into the sea. And if your hand causes you to fall away, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life maimed than to have two hands and go to hell, the unquenchable fire. If your foot causes you to fall away, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life lame than to have two feet and be thrown into hell. And if your eye causes you to fall away, gouge it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into hell where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. For everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but if the salt should lose its flavor, how can you season it? Have salt among yourselves and be at peace with one another. Oh, I just love how Jesus is so clear sometimes. Just to clarify, he's using a mixture of illustration, metaphor, and hyperbole, which just makes it easier, doesn't it, to just piece together. But he does it intentionally. Make no mistake, though he uses those language techniques, there is a seriousness to his words that we need to comprehend. Because I've never been so struck by Jesus' passion for justice and righteousness than I am when I hear these words. There is a scene where Jesus goes to the temple. He puts a cord, like he builds a whip, in other words, goes to the temple, throws tables over, yells at people, whips things, and shows an expression of anger. But I reckon this scares me more than that. Because after shifting the disciples' perceptions of greatness and servanthood, he, while I'm assuming still holding the child, says, if anyone causes this little one who believes in me to fall away, or in other words, to cause them to sin, then they should tie a large rock around their neck and throw themselves in the sea. Jesus just said, if you were to cause one of my little children intentionally to sin, to fall away, to no longer trust in him, you'd better off killing yourself. I've never been more struck by Jesus' words about the seriousness of sin than I am here. Think about when you say that, if you've ever said it, to a human being. Go kill yourself. How jarring that is. Imagine what Jesus is trying to convey in this moment about the seriousness of trusting in him and the seriousness of causing someone to fall away and not trust in him no longer, to sin. Beloved, sin isn't a small inconvenience we have as human beings. Sin isn't just the naughty things we do. Sin isn't just about behavior. Sin is more deeper and profound and serious than those things. Sin is the core problem in this world. More serious than climate change, cancel culture, and Christians, it is more serious than our religious freedom. Sin is what is tearing our world apart. And sin is our natural disposition, our natural slavery, if you like. The rejection of God as ultimate and the trust of something else, whether it's myself or some other thing, as ultimate. Our sinful hearts make other things as functional saviors and gods, whether it's my family, my job, my money, my career, whether it's the location, my holiday, We naturally make other things our saviors and our gods, the things we serve and love and bow down to and give our time to. And it's this problem that Jesus came to address. The point is simple, beloved. If Jesus cares about the seriousness of sin, even to the point of death, then so should we who claim to follow him. Yet I want to ask, how often do we flirt with sin? How often would we rather cut off things that cause us to sin? Instead, we would rather just play with it. Maybe try it a little bit. Oh, it's okay. I'll excuse it. Oh, yeah, the internet. You know, I look on my phone. Yeah, that's okay. Like, I'll get it under control. Oh, yeah, I talk about others. But it's only with close friends. It's okay to sometimes unload what I'm going through. Do we get that sin is serious enough? Serious enough that Jesus uses the hyperbole of saying it's almost better that you cut your eye, your hand, or your foot. Now, he's not being literal. I do need to clarify that. There was a monk who tried that. Didn't go well for him. Another story. But Jesus is trying to help those he loved to avoid a much devastating consequence. You see, to ignore the seriousness of sin is to ignore the seriousness of its consequence, which is hell. And just because we don't have time, I wish I did, hell, if you like, I'm going to be really quick with this, is described in the most vivid language by Jesus himself. You want to know who spoke more about hell? It's Jesus himself, the most loving person on the planet. And I know people get uncomfortable with it, but I think it's because they don't quite understand what it is and why it's there. So if I quickly say two quick things about hell. Firstly, it is far worse than unquenchable fire or ever-eating worms. That's helpful. But it is. Jesus is trying to use language to describe something that is even worse than that. He's trying to go, what hurts? Fire. Imagine unquenchable fire, a fire that never goes out. Imagine worms that just eat inside of you, but they never die, and neither do you. That is how bad hell is. But I would say he would argue it's worse. Secondly, it's worse not because God is cruel, but because the rejection of God, life without him, is the worst reality anyone could ever face. C.S. Lewis rightly says that hell is the greatest monument to human freedom. Think about that. Hell is the greatest monument to human freedom. Hell is doing life without the life giver. And Jesus does not want anyone to perish there. And so God gave his one and only son so that we wouldn't even taste a flicker of that reality. Beloved, sin, hell is serious. You want to know what's going in Ukraine? Sin. And so Jesus says to them, we are to be salt. Now I'm going to summarize a whole bunch of tricky statements, but Jesus is saying salt by its very nature, if it's no longer salty, it's no longer salt. You can't have saltless salt. Does that make sense? Like if it's not salt, salty, it's just dirt. And so Jesus says, you are to be salt. You are to be my follower. To not be my follower and not live the way I've called you to does not make sense. He's trying to say, if you're going to follow me, you are to live differently by your very nature, by that very confession that Jesus is King means you are different. But beloved, that is a beautiful thing for us. Because it means we don't need to pretend or be distraught. Because our transcendent King came to die for us and came to help us with our sin. And so we're able, instead of arguing about who is greater, to have peace with each other in this reality. Let me close off with this example. The other day, my son was sent to his room after a stream of choices that he made that got him in trouble. We often have these moments. But in those moments, I often find him lying in his bed. And this is just a simple gesture, but when I come into the room, he's laying on his bed. He always makes room for me. And so I lay down and I cuddle with him. And we usually talk about what happened, talk about our hearts, talk about the heart of the problem and how do we move forward. But I was struck the other day as I held him when his little words came out. Dad, I'm just terrible. I just can't do it. I'm a failure. I try to do the right thing and I stuff it up all the time. That wasn't the words that struck me. It was everything else he was doing. He was clinging to me, not wanting me to remove him from his embrace. He was crying and feeling free to express his heart. And as I reassured him, but son, you know, Josh, that's why Jesus came. That's why Daddy needs him. That's why you need him. Because he knew we couldn't do it. We need his help. We need his forgiveness. It was in that moment that my son got what so many of us struggle to get. That we can sit in our Savior's and our King's embrace and confess and repent and weep and yet rest assured that we're held. It was in that moment I finally got why Jesus grabbed the child before his disciples and held them before him when they talked about who was greater, when he talks about the seriousness of sin. He wants you to get there is no better place than in his arms. And just like my son trusts me enough to confess and to feel safe and to know that I'm not going to throw him out. So, beloved, we need to trust in our King. Let's pray.